want you to imagine that you're living in a different, faraway country, and your friend Tom comes to seek advice from you. He's been married to Katie for 42 years, but this past year, Tom has been living that nightmare where he has discovered his wife has been unfaithful with many of their good friends. They've had a divorce. Katie's got remarried, but this new marriage only lasted for 2 weeks, and another divorce is coming through. And Tom comes to you and asks the question, do you think I have any chance of getting back with Katie? Now, what would you say to him on that day? The problem is, in this country, added to that, there is a very strict law that you can't remarry someone who has divorced you, especially if the woman has already had two divorces. So Tom is under no obligation to take Katie in, and you work all this through with Tom. Tom, are you willing to risk this? Are you willing to risk humiliation again? Look at Katie's track record. Don't you want to let her get sorted out first before you come in and get involved? Or maybe you work through some conditions with Tom. Do you establish some boundaries to try and rebuild trust? Do you try and discuss what went wrong and encourage some confession, some repentance? And you really sense the tension in Tom, who desperately wants to rekindle intimacy, but there's this huge risk of losing himself, losing self-regard. Is this outrageous hope, or is it unrealistic expectations? Is it fantasy? Well, Tom is not a fictional character in a fictional world, because this is the real question in Jeremiah that God asks of us. We are the Katies in this situation. We are the fickle ones, and God is asking the question of us, will you give me another chance? And our passage today is part of this big, long section, a discussion that starts with the Torah law, which says if a man divorces his wife and she leaves him and marries another man, should he return to her again? And the people who were hearing this question automatically knew what the Torah said. No man is obliged to take a woman back because she had defiled herself. And yet, despite what the law says, Yahweh has this yearning for his people. He doesn't want to let go of them. He doesn't want to give them up. He has a love that's so great, it dares to violate the very holy Torah that he wrote himself. And to show this stark contrast between the resilient, loving determination of Yahweh, who's deeply faithful, and the fickle fancy of the people, even the very form of words in Jeremiah reflects the sharp contrast. Whenever the woman is described, she's described in flat, plain, direct prose. She's the one on the roadside who will wait for any man to pick her up. But in contrast, Yahweh's desires are described in poetry, in metaphor. Imagine a father who his whole life has been working laboriously, accumulating a glorious inheritance for his son. And he waits and waits for that day when the son grows up and will respond and take what is being offered to him. But sadly, the son doesn't grow up and the son doesn't care. And do you see the contrast between this woman who probably thought she had the exciting life, only to find it gloomy and monotonous and boring? But God, who you might think, well, this is just boring steadiness, there's this beautiful poetic surprise that God is so willing to pour himself into this relationship that he's willing to rewrite his own rules. There's nothing boring about that. And yes, the Torah says, we have no right to return to Yahweh. We're the rebellious ones. The Torah also says, Yahweh is under no obligation to take us back. But it's in this poetry, it's in this metaphor, we see that God is the one who keeps cutting open hope way beyond the righteousness of the Torah, risking humiliation and defilement in order to keep a marriage alive. It's beautiful. But sadly, in Jerusalem, there are just too many idols that seem attractive to the people. There's this temple ideology. The people think, we'll just stay here in Jerusalem because that's where everything will work out all right in the end. This is our security. And they had pulled and tied God right down to this political ideology. And not only did it become self-serving, it was self-deceiving. So the people just didn't get it. So the question becomes, who will teach this people how to feel? Who is going to teach this people how to feel again? A couple of weeks ago, a member of our congregation came to my office and told me about an article in the New York Times called Who Will Teach This People How to Feel? And the subtext is, when art shrinks to the size of politics. David Brooks talks about how his friends were asked to name in the last few decades 25 pieces of artwork that were memorable. And as they came up with this list of the 25 pieces of artwork, some common themes began to emerge. He realized that most of the art was to do with politics, that the posture the artist had adopted were less beautiful creations to be experienced, but more often political statements to be decoded. And the idea that beauty is something transcendent and yields a truth larger than the human condition had grown thin. And Brooks goes on to say that this emotional range in art, or Feldman Barrett's terms, the emotional granularity, that broad repertoire of ways we can feel, has grown thin. It's diminishing. Who will teach us how to feel? And when Brooks asks the question at the start of his article, he doesn't find an answer. And I wonder, too, if the pressure to hold on to our faith in the right kind of ideological container has shrunk our ability to feel the heartbeat of God. Have we had to accelerate our understanding of depersonalized technology, where every institution has to claw their way around the communications industry, all under the pressure of building the kingdom, working for the kingdom, getting the mission? Have we begun to treat God and others more like machines and less like part of the body, where we feel each other? Oh yes, we've plans, we've programs, we've visions and goals, but who will teach us how to feel? Is it the resilient love of a husband calling us out? Surely that's enough to woo us back. But sadly, it's not. And so Jeremiah takes us to another place. The poetry's still there, but it's not love poetry. It's war poetry. Because the leaders of the Jerusalem establishment were touting slogans to pull the people into believing it's going to work out all right in the end. But they were denying reality. Things were much worse than what they thought. And the work of art is to bring this greater reality than what can be immediately seen. And so in chapter 4, Jeremiah's poetry begins to pick up with pace and vigor, and he gives us metaphor after metaphor, five different metaphors, none of which bear any relation to each other. But now he goes to a place where creation is the metaphor. This is where we read our passage today. Creation is the metaphor, and it's unraveling at a startling pace. Jeremiah says, "I looked, and the earth was formless and empty." These are the same words to describe what creation was like before there was a creation. It was formless. It was empty. Jeremiah says, "I looked and the light was gone. The mountains, the very substance that should provide stability, they're shaking. I looked and I couldn't see any people or birds. The fruitful land was a desert." And you see creation getting destroyed because chaos is so dominant. As the message describes it, this is pre-Genesis chaos. All the towns are like ghost towns. Have you ever seen a city that once was vibrant, but as people move out to the suburbs, the center becomes that ghost place? That's a picture of what we become when we detach ourselves from the Creator, when we're disobedient to God. We become ghost towns. Our cities become ghost towns. And each time Jeremiah says those words, I looked, there's that rhythm. Doesn't that remind you of the creation story where God looked and saw what? That it was good. But Jeremiah looked and saw now that it was bad. Things have changed. Because what is happening here is not utopia, but dystopia. A picture of Eden gone horribly wrong. So why is he doing this? Why is Jeremiah giving us a picture of dystopia, of creation crumbling away? Is he going to tell the people this is what's going to happen? Creation is literally going to crumble away. What's the point? Well, when Margaret Atwood, you maybe know The Handmaid's Tale, she wrote it in 1985 in West Berlin, many years ago, she tried to imagine dystopia. What would America be like when everything's gone wrong? Where Christian fundamentalists overthrow the government? When environmental calamity gets so bad, many people are infertile and handmaids become slaves, stripped of their identity in order to reproduce. And Atwood said she wrote this twisted dystopian reality to help society figure out where it was going. And I wonder if it's the same here. God gives Jeremiah this picture of creation unraveling to try and engage a numbed community, an unaware community, a complacent community into this imaginative engagement and embrace of what's going on. He wanted them to face the reality before it's too late. So creation is unraveling at this alarming rate. But then comes a wonderful surprise. God says, "This is not the end of the world. I'm not going to destroy it completely." John Calvin says, it's almost like the workman is taking a break from his work. He puts down his tools. He pauses from destroying creation completely. And God steps back. Is this the place where we find hope? As we wait to see how it's all going to work out, how the final consummation will be, there's this pause, and all you hear is the sound of earth itself weeping, this groaning. Can you imagine the earth weeping, the heavens growing dark? Can you imagine creation groaning like in childbirth right up to the present time? Can you imagine us groaning inwardly as we wait for all things to be made new in the hope that we'll be saved? I wonder, in this pause where God steps back, do you see something more? Do you see the pause? that happened on Good Friday? Do you see the Savior with his arms wide on the cross, waiting, taking on the blazing anger of a God who sent in all the destructive forces on him? Because the reality is, the blazing anger of God is deeply connected to the blazing love of God. Maybe it's a pause to remember that the warnings and threats are not to guilt us into awakening, but to see the deep longings of a love that dares to pause in the hope that one day we will return. Maybe it's a pause to consider that if this is what it looks like, if the disruption of creation is a picture of what's going on in our insides between God and us, if mountains are trembling and hills are swaying, what does that say about how messed up we are and how much we need rescue? Maybe it's a pause to consider that our salvation came not when God said, "Let there be light," but when Jesus paused, because that was all he could do when he was hanging on the cross and he said those words, "My God, you forsook me." And the heavens wept, and the earth trembled, and the sky went dark. In this metaphor of unmaking creation, we see a hint of what it's going to take to have a new creation. That Jesus came to reconcile all things, whether on heaven or on earth, by making peace through his blood poured out on the cross. So I want to ask you, what is your response today to all of this? In our city today, how do we live when we realize it is the Son of God himself who's teaching us how to feel? Well, one false response is to do what one of the next metaphors say in Jeremiah. It talks about a woman who gets up and puts her makeup on and her earrings and her jewelry and does her hair and tries to create a beautiful picture of who she is, but nothing has changed. And all through history, we do that, don't we? We think of ways we can dress up new worlds on blank canvases. As Willie Jennings explains, we continue to think of slave ships as the continuing creative act, finding new places and new worlds with ships named Hope. And we need to challenge these perverted views of creation. So instead of doing that, let's imagine how we faithfully can sing God's song in a strange land. I wonder if you've seen the film The Mission. That beautiful, beautiful film set in 1758 in those borderlands of Argentina and Brazil. And Father Gabriel and his community of Jesuits risk their lives to bring the gospel to the Guarani. And the first encounter Father Gabriel makes is through playing his oboe, such a beautiful way. And through that peaceful witness makes a connection, makes reconciliation. And Father Gabriel comes to them with a new song that the Guarani will make their own. As the cardinal tells the Pope, with an orchestra, the Jesuits could have subdued a whole continent. And so the Indians of the Guarani were brought into the everlasting mercy of God. But you probably know the end of the story. Because God may be merciful, but man so often is not. And European politics dictated that the Jesuits should leave so that the Guarani could be taken up and brought to the Portuguese slave trade. But they refused to leave, and the Jesuits refused to leave too. They risk having their entire order expelled in Europe. But the film ends with Father Gabriel walking with the heavenly host in his hand, and he's shot dead in solidarity with the Guarani, who are also slaughtered. But here's the thing. As the cardinal receives the report of the slaughter, he asks, "Was this necessary?" And the reply came, Well, I did what I had to do given the legitimate purpose which you sanctioned. You had no alternative, Your Eminence. We must work in the world, and the world is thus. But the cardinal realizes he is complicit in this and says, "Ah, but we made this world. We were the creators of it, and thus I have made this problem." And when you encounter a love that's willing to go into destruction, it deconstructs all our false notions of how we competitively try to create new worlds. And today, when the world is urbanizing at this alarming rate, you have a calling, like Jeremiah, to be this witness in this city. For those who've lived this story, who know this story of divorce and unfaithfulness, hear the words that God would override all of creation for you. That's stunning. And for those of you who've got so caught up in the competition of this city, and you're numb to these feelings again, Christ is calling you back too, to consider authentic, faithful, loving, and living. And for those of us who have shrunk our faith to the size of our life and our politics, Jeremiah dares us to see more, to join in the groaning of creation. No, even more than that, to join in the very suffering of Christ, who through death came to bring a new creation. So maybe it's time to stop living in denial and lean into this calling, to look for this faithful love, to seek the welfare of a city where, yes, there are destructive, life-draining practices. Yes, creation is deteriorating. This is not a calling just to take the path of personal suffering. It's nothing less than an invitation to sink deep into the suffering of Jesus Christ, who through death brings new creation. So who will teach us how to feel? Well, we go to the one who went beyond the law to show how to love our enemies. We go to the one who went beyond the law to draw us back, even if it meant humiliation. We go to the one about whom was prophesied, "The Lord your God is with you. He's mighty to save. He'll comfort you with his love. He will rejoice over you with singing." That's where we go, the firstborn of creation. In him things all were created in heaven and earth, things seen and unseen. In him all things hold together. Who will teach us how to feel? Go to the cross, and you'll find your answer there.